Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to
do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest from peterbcollins.com. It's made possible not by corporate underwriters, but by individuals like you who listen and subscribe. My thanks to Stephen King, Joey Hundert, Faith Peoples, and Michael Gill. Get the scoop on subscriptions and our bonus book offer. Share it with your friends. All the details are on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Shall we do a little fracking? Let's get an update on fracking. Steve Horn joins us on the Peter B. Collins Show.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below. The groundwater pumped into American homes, but don't tell it to the residents of Subway Way. Oh, that water's fracked. We're talking benzene.
I like benzene for breakfast. I don't know about you. That is a pretty cool tune, and I want to thank Steve Horn for suggesting that and turning us on to it today. And I'll put up a link in the show file at peterbcollins.com so you can go to YouTube and watch it yourself. It's called the fracking song, My Water's on Fire Tonight, and it was produced by a group of journalism students at NYU. Steve Horn returns to our program. He is a research fellow at DSmog Blog. Hello, Steve.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And tell us a little bit about this this song and how you relate to it.
Sure. I think the song was made last summer of 2011. I ran into it because I read ProPublica. I think the song was made in partnership with that website, and they've been doing some of the best coverage on fracking. That's actually how I originally learned about the issue. So just through their daily coverage on the issue, I stumbled upon the song, and I think the song really sums up kind of all the concerns with fracking really nicely. So
yeah,
and well, in a catchy way.
Give me your sense of the big picture here. Do you believe that the public is starting to understand the dimensions of hydraulic fracturing, the impact on the environment, particularly in local groundwater and related issues? What do you think the progress is so far, if we just peg it to the last 2 years, since at least that's when I would say I first became aware of the consequences of this process?
I would say that in the past couple of years, like you, that's when I started following the issue, and the general public's knowledge of it has picked up greatly. I mean, that's kind of right around the time when Josh Fox's documentary Gasland was finally released to a public audience in on HBO. I think like not that long after that, really people started learning about it around the country. So the grassroots sort of fight against fracking grows every day. Knowledge of it grows every day. And sort of all the different concerns with the industry as a whole are growing. I think people used to talk only about things such as fracking, which means deep water, slick water injection to get this hard to obtain substance out of the ground. That's only one element of the process. There is things such as sand mining, there are pipelines, there are many elements to.
We got wastewater issues.
Wastewater issues with the brine. I think the public's knowledge of all the concerns, rather than just what the industry wanted, was to talk about was how it burns more cleanly than coal when it's actually used as like a fuel source or home heating source. That was how they got away with what they got away with for a long time, without talking about everything that came before the whole life cycle. And I'd say the biggest thing that really turned the table was the Cornell University study last spring, spring of 2011, in which Haworth and Graphia revealed through meticulous scientific research that the entire life cycle of shale gas is actually dirtier, potentially much dirtier than coal, which is actually really scary to ponder.
That is, but, yeah, because, of course, coal's clean now.
Yeah, coal is clean.
I've heard the propaganda at the Republican convention, you know, and they paint Obama as anti-coal.
Right.
I do think he has, you know, some good instincts about trying to move us away from coal, but he's hardly attacked the industry. And
no.
I just learned that at Romney's coal miner photo op in Ohio last week, that the miners were forced to show up. And some were told that their pay would be docked or that they might even be fired if they didn't produce the human backdrop for Mitt Romney's pro-coal photo op.
Yikes. And that, these industries have so much power over the political system that the Democrats and Republicans and the two political party, Obama versus Romney are competing against each other to see who's more pro-coal, which has to do with the industry flooding the system with so much money that the talking points of the industry have become the talking points of the two candidates. And the same thing is true of gas. If you're familiar with talking points for shale gas, both political candidates for president have adopted those talking points in terms of the 100 years of shale gas and jobs and, you know.
Yep,
that's just how it works.
That's
but,
how it's being spun up. Now
that,
go ahead.
On the contrary, people who live in these areas do know very well that none of those talking points are true, but none of those people's voices are being heard. In 2012 in this election year. But
that's where I wanted to go, because in the Marcellus Shale region. Which is in the Midwest, where I grew up. I'm from Ohio, and it starts really in northern Ohio and Pennsylvania and parts of what's called upstate New York, but I consider it the southern portion of upstate New York. So that is our equivalent of the Caspian region that we seem hell-bent on extracting at all costs. Now, I know about the earthquakes in Ohio. They didn't happen when I was a kid before we were drilling this way. And it appears that Governor Cuomo is ready to write off a few counties on that southern border with Pennsylvania and just say, well, you know, you can do whatever you want down here, and I'm going to be green elsewhere. And then in Pennsylvania, captive to a Republican governor and a lot of hardliners, the establishment is showing just, you know, let's bend over for the gas industry and, you know, see how much we can actually pass. That's an ugly metaphor. but what I wanted to ask about is, what about the stakeholders, the people who own these properties and have signed leases with gas exploration companies? Are any of them having second thoughts and organizing in ways to try to protect their interests after the fact? Many of them, I think, took the money without understanding the real implications, and I imagine some of them have some remorse about that.
Yeah, one of the most interesting examples in Pennsylvania, I'll use a single case study, but he is a leader of sort of the grassroots in southeast Pennsylvania, is a guy named Ron Gula, who signed a deal with Range Resources in 2005. This is well before the movie Gasland was was even being shot, I think, or maybe it was being shot, but it wasn't. No one knew about who Josh Fox was. No one knew about the movie. No one knew about the issue. He signed this deal with Range Resources, and his entire farm was destroyed, basically. He had 8 wells on his property. And today he has huge regrets about going into it without knowing what he was getting into, and sort of as a ringleader in Southeast Pennsylvania for people who are trying to, at this point, the industry's so far into the state that all they can really do is try to get it to act more responsibly, which is not happening whatsoever. But if you look, you know, there's many Ron Gulas there. There's a Ron Gula in Colorado. There's a Ron Gula in, there's lots of Ron Gulas in New York. There's lots of Ron Gulas in Pennsylvania. These people either were duped into signing deals, not knowing what they're signing deals for, or they were really just manipulated and cajoled into doing it and pressured into doing it, saying, well, your neighbor has signed a deal. Your other neighbor signed a deal. It's in your best interest to do so. And plus, the way that hydraulic fracturing works is a horizontal drilling process. So, you know, it still could be under your property, even though you didn't sign away. They basically need to get large plots of land. They can't just sporadically piece of property here. They need large, you know, many groupings of properties in order for it to work. So, you know, if there's a stand, if there's someone who's being a hindrance to that plan, then they can be severely punished, usually in the legal system, which the industry has bought off, especially in these rural counties, and that was apparent when I talked to Ron Gula. So there's interesting backlash against it. Unfortunately, in Pennsylvania, like you alluded to, the state government's been completely bought off by the gas industry, and as of 2010, when the Republicans took over the government in Pennsylvania, there's really little chance of the grassroots activist concerns actually being listened to or heard. So,
well, but why would we listen to real people who have experience with the downside of fracking when we have an industry that is buying politicians, paying for propaganda on television that just doesn't simply promote the interests of the extractors, but also uses dolls, human beings of various diverse types, to say that I vote. They're basically threatening the political system with the muscle that they are able to muster. And then we have to bring in Alec. And I want to say that I'm so proud of you and others in Madison, Wisconsin, because the Center for Media and Democracy and other groups there have worked very hard to expose the American Legislative Exchange Council. And it is now not quite a household word, but at least among people who listen to this podcast, I know they're aware of the work that Alec does, the so-called model legislation that they have managed to introduce often across many state legislatures, and the way that they have networked to buy political influence at the state house level. And so talk a little bit about the regulations that Alec promoted, particularly in Pennsylvania, and what amounts to at least a temporary victory for anti-fracking interests in a recent court ruling.
Sure. So I traced the fact, and others were kind of familiar with the fact that it might be an Alec bill, but I went ahead and did the research and kind of showed that it looks like Pennsylvania Act 13, which was called the gag order bill, which like kind of silenced citizens who may have been harmed by fracking with not being, their doctors are not able to talk about these cases in courts. And on top of that, basically the key that would show that it was a model bill was the anti-zoning regulations that said that zoning is a hindrance to the industry. So local democracy should not exist in terms of zoning. So citizens don't have a right to say, well, you can frack here, but not here. that those rights were gotten rid of in Pennsylvania. That's Act 13, but that also that bill has passed in other states, or has been tried to attempt to be passed in other states, such as Colorado, Texas, and other states. So it's pretty obvious if you see that things are spreading in many states that it could be a model bill. Basically, it was an ALEC model bill that was passed in the late 2000s, which means that it was an oil and gas industry bill written by oil and gas industry lobbyists and pushed at an ALEC meeting and passed, and it became a model. So what happened was this summer, Pennsylvania Act 13 was ruled unconstitutional by the Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court, which is actually kind of interesting that it happened, given that Pennsylvania, like we talked about, has been so corrupted by the oil and gas industry, and that there's so much money from the oil and gas industry flowing into Pennsylvania state legislature. So maybe there's something to be said about a slightly independent judiciary. Although what happened is the Corbett administration in Pennsylvania immediately appealed this Commonwealth Court decision, and it will be heard in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in the near future. But it's, you know, we'll see. I don't know how, I'm not familiar with the dynamics of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court enough to know how much that's been kind of bought off. I know in Wisconsin, that court has been kind of bought off by right-wing corporate front groups. And
you had an election that I regard as highly suspect of a Supreme Court justice, where the Democrat won on election night, and whoops, Kathy Nicholas found 15,000 votes on her personal computer that changed the outcome of that, and then the Democrats didn't fight it. It was extremely disappointing.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, if the movie Hot Coffee shows anything, it's that the right wing has had a very concerted effort to insert right wing justices into state Supreme Courts around the country. Well, it's not really something that most people pay attention to, but if you look at something like Pennsylvania Act 13, it's a pretty high-stakes case.
Yeah. Well, and the court packing you're talking about, we can attribute to Karl Rove. He really sharpened his political campaign shop around electing Supreme Court justices all across the South, starting in Texas, Alabama, Mississippi. And we have covered in depth the Don Siegelman case on this program, which is, all roads there lead to Rove and his manipulations, with a little help from Jack Abramoff and a few other people along the way. And I will just add that it is so offensive to see him sit as a Fox News commentator when he is a major player in the dark PACs, the political action committees like Crossroads, GPS, that do not disclose their donors and are likely funded by just a handful of billionaires, many of whom have direct interest in the resource extraction industries. And so that loop is a real ugly one, and it generally goes uncriticized. I just couldn't resist. Now, coming back to Act 13, it seems to me that we have a fundamental conflict inside the conservative wing of the Republican Party, because they support drill, baby, drill. We don't care about the consequences. And they, of course, mislead people about whether this will actually produce jobs and cheaper energy. They lie on both sides of those factors. But the fundamental property rights that people enjoy and the ability of local jurisdictions to determine the property rules and the land use decisions seems to have been badly eroded, not only at the state level, but with the preemption that occurred at the federal level during the Bush-Cheney years.
Yep, and I guess summing that up, also the whole small government talking point. Keep the government's hands off of my property, my liberty. I mean, that's such, and you look at something like this ALEC model bill, it's big government. It's corporations mandating that the government not allow, you know, the federal government not allow, and state governments not allow local democracy to exist. So it's, you know, at the most local level, which they talk about a lot, talk about keep the federal government off our backs. We'll allow states and local governments to handle it because they know the situation best. Well, that's been turned on its head here. They're basically saying that you're not allowed to have local democracy. You're not allowed to solve these things through your city council. I mean, your city council has become null and void under Pennsylvania Act 13 in terms of dealing with the industry coming into your city or village or municipality. It's just eliminated.
And Steve, to the extent you know about this Commonwealth Court decision declaring Act 13 unconstitutional, was it the entire measure, including the gag order on doctors who could not openly testify about the adverse health impacts on their patients?
As far as I know, it was actually, I could be wrong, which I feel bad about, but basically I think that it was just the zoning portion of it. It was not, so there's still some of the nastier elements of it weren't challenged by the Commonwealth Court, just the zoning portion of it was challenged. And as I said before, it was immediately appealed by the Corbett administration, and it will eventually be heard in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Now, Steve, I want to shift now to a discussion of some of the nuts and bolts of fracking. And I was struck by one of your blog posts at dsmogblog.com about how sand from western Wisconsin is being extracted and shipped to these various fracking sites. So take a moment to talk about that impact. I don't think I've actually ever been to that part of Wisconsin, and I know there's sand dunes along Lake Michigan in Indiana, but I don't know that there are massive sand deposits. At any rate, start there, and then tell us a little bit about the elements that go into the cocktail that is pumped into the ground in order to loosen up the underground geology and you know, allow this gas to be extracted.
Sure. So, you know, Wisconsin has become the epicenter of the sand mining boom that has accompanied the fracking boom around the United States. Basically, geologists who have studied the geology of sand formations around the United States have seen that in western Wisconsin, also eastern Minnesota, in the Winona area of Minnesota, there exists like so much silica sand. And the silica sand is fine grain and circular, and it's perfect for the being used as a propant to prop open these shale basins, also with the it opens up the space in the ground and allows the rest of the cocktail to break up the shale and go and get to the gas that's located so far under the ground.
So if I may, the sand is like a suspended solid in the liquid that is pumped underground, and it has the effect of like a scouring pad or something. It has the abrasion that causes soil and other elements to break up to create a pathway for access to the gas that is buried further under.
Correct. Yeah. And so this sand, basically, in the, you know, the past few years, like Pennsylvania has seen a fracking boom, western Wisconsin has seen a sand boom. So there's tons of trucks and tons of rail, like freight cars, and just it's becoming completely industrialized in places that, you know, the rural communities, they're not used to seeing heavy industry of this sort there, mostly farming communities. And I guess the biggest fear of the sand rush is the fact that the sand, silica sand, can cause silicosis, and OSHA said that was actually one of their biggest concerns for workers that were working on fracking sites, is the fact that breathing in the silica sand on site could be really harmful for people.
Steve, we lost our Skype connection, and the leaf blower guy downstairs interrupted us. We are now reconnected. The leaf blower is silent. And so let's pick up where I think we left off. We were talking about some of the mechanics of hydraulic fracturing, and we talked about the extraction of silica sand, which I guess is the best shit for this process, from western Wisconsin and parts of Minnesota. Now, one of the other interesting factors here is that the railroad that Warren Buffett bought a couple of years ago, called BNSF, Burlington Northern, Santa Fe, which, by the way, is an underwriter of the Public Television NewsHour, and they have this folksy little railroad propaganda piece that rolls at the beginning of many of their broadcasts, and it probably inoculates the coverage of fracking and the transportation benefits to corporations like BNSF and investors like Warren Buffett. But talk a little bit about some of these people who are cashing in on the fracking boom.
Sure. Interestingly, you bring up Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett's BNSF recently signed a deal with U.S. Silica Sand, which is a major corporation that it's like a kind of like holding company of sand, of like all these mini sand corporations that are popping up in different areas in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And there's a little bit of sand mining in Texas too, and in Arkansas, but it's mostly in the Midwest. Anyway, BNSF signed this deal to be a major transporter of this fracking sand to various shale plays or shale basins around the country. And, you know, on top of that, I had covered in previous installments the fact that BNSF is a major transporter of tar sands equipment, mm-hmm. and even possibility they can actually transport the fuel, like they transport coal. They can transport through expensive equipment. They can, instead of using pipelines, they can kind of have tanks of tar sands, mm-hmm. oil, or whatever you want to call it, bitumen on the trains. So if there's a backlog in terms of something like the Keystone XL, well, BNSF will fill its void and move the oil around the country, and it has capacity to move, about a million barrels of tar sands oil a day around North America. So BNSF is cashing in. So are other rail lines such as Union Pacific and Canadian National. And actually, an interesting prelude to all of that is the fact that in the 1800s, there was the Common Carrier Act, which I think journalists need to look into it more, but essentially a bill that mandated that railroad companies cannot deny, I don't think they'd want to based on making money anyway, but they can't deny contracts with, say, coal companies or tar sands companies with the claim that it's dangerous for the public, just because they're treated as a common carrier, kind of the same way as natural gas pipelines are, mm-hmm. for fueling homes. So mm-hmm. it's kind of interesting that there's a legal mandate for them to do what they do. And a lot of that probably had to do with the robber barons in the late 1800s. And you could say that today we're living in the new age of the robber barons, or robber barons 2.0.
Well, and Steve, I was really stunned by a recent report I read about another type of fracking profiteer, and that is a wastewater company in Pennsylvania. And I want you in a moment to explain how much effluent this process produces and what the drillers are actually doing with it. But obviously, when you pump all this fluid into the ground and it's supposed to, like an enema, help bring out the gas, you got to do something with that wastewater. And a contractor in Pennsylvania has been found to just take this toxic wastewater and dump it in sewer drains, on private property, put it into ponds. And it appears that there's actually no environmental regulation, or at least if there is, it's not being enforced, related to the disposal of wastewater from fracking.
Right. And, we should talk about, we're talking about injection and brine injection and what's happening with this water. There's lots of pieces to it. I guess piece number one is the alarming trend of water privatization and collusion between private water companies, seeing that water is becoming an increasingly scarce resource, especially in the age of droughts, but actually especially in the age of fracking, in which water is becoming contaminated. So there's collusion. I mean, Food and Water Watch has written a number of really good reports, scathing reports on the collusion between these water profiteers and shale gas drilling companies. On top of that, there's what's happening in Ohio with what actually happens when this contaminated water, what do they do with it? What do they do with this radioactive, dirty, horrendous substance that one time was water? And they're injecting this brine into the ground in places like Youngstown, Ohio. What's resulting in earthquakes, unprecedented amounts of earthquakes, and not just there, but also there's been earthquakes in the Eagle Ford Shale in Texas and earthquakes in Arkansas, places that are they're not in what normally...
They got no fault lines like California.
Right. They're not... the correlation can pretty clearly be seen between this brine water injection and earthquakes and the moving around of tectonic plates that had never been moved around in such a way. It's man-made. So it's pretty scary stuff, and you're dealing with a lot of money and a lot of powerful people, and who basically I've been told by Peter Montague, activist who deals with carbon sequestration, carbon capture and storage in New Jersey, and he says that the guys that are dealing with the this type of thing like brine water or carbon capture and storage, well, it's kind of equivalent to, he says, the mafia, and that the the mafia is who always dealt with the garbage business. Yeah. What's the garbage? So yeah. Pretty scary stuff, and that's kind of what's happening in Pennsylvania right now, but also around the country.
I mean, this guy's name wasn't Tony Soprano, but he's been in the waste business for a while. He's apparently grown substantially because of the fracking boom, and it sounds like some of his tanker trucks load up and then just drive down the road with the drain open, and they just don't care. Now, you use the word radioactive to describe some of this effluent. Is it truly something that can be measured as toxic in that direction?
In terms of what's known, there's lots that's unknown because of the Halliburton loophole that was written into the Energy Policy Act of 2005 under the Bush administration, in which the Bush administration gave the oil and gas industry carte blanche to basically write that law and come to tons of meetings early on in the administration's time in office. And what resulted was this, that they wanted to be exempt from the Clean Water Act and these basically any type of regulations they were exempt from following for fracking. So lots of things are not known because they don't have to disclose any of it. But some valiant scientists, such as at Duke University, have discovered that there are large traces of benzene in drinking water in a few shale basins. So the Duke study came out in 2011, kind of not too long after that Cornell study I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. That was one of the most damning ones. There's also a EPA study that was conducted in Garfield, Colorado, earlier this year, which also tied water contamination and fracking together. And there's an EPA study that's going to come out probably after the presidential election that I'm assuming will show more of the same. The sad thing about it is, although it will probably show that politics are coming in front of just releasing the study, I mean, I'm sure the study's already done and they just don't want, because of the presidential election, they don't want the two candidates, Obama administration has endorsed fracking, so their guy who's endorsing fracking is kind of twinned to this process that's contaminating people's water around the United States. Oh, they're just kind of punting this one until after the election.
Mm-hmm. Now, Steve, one other question for you just about the impact of this. You talked about the earthquakes in areas that are not seismically active. And here in California, I'm familiar with areas where we have overpumped the groundwater, and it produces subsidence. The surface collapses. I do at least have a general idea that this fracking is going on far enough underground that the topsoil may not be affected. But have there been any indications of long-term settling of soil or other types of subsidence that may occur below the upper strata that would have long-term negative impacts?
You know, I haven't actually followed sort of the soil science side of this at all, although it seems inevitable that that would be the case, just because there's so many chemicals that are being injected into the ground, and because it's not a natural, you know, it's not how the ecosystem works. I mean, it's not used to human interruptions of it in that way. So although it would, you know, it avoids topsoil, everything that's underneath that's buried, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet under the ground, that's all being interrupted. And my hypothesis is that's the case. Also, it's something I need to look into because I'm ignorant on it.
Okay. But, well, I'm curious, and you know more than I do, but I'm happy to have you look into that. And maybe the next time we talk, we can discuss it. Well, finally today, I want to take a look at some of the politics here. In case you missed it, the I believe it was Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, but those right-wingers kind of run together in my mind as I've been trying to watch parts of the Republican convention. But they renamed the Environmental Protection Agency the Employment Prevention Agency. And this is part of their whole set of talking points about job-killing regulations. And they, of course, blow past workplace safety issues and local environmental impacts and even larger environmental impacts, such as climate change, global warming. But talk a little bit about the recent setback by the court that ruled against the EPA in the coal, the issues of coal effluent smokestacks. And what your sense is of the EPA's ability, given the political climate and Obama's tilt toward extractors, is the EPA still a viable regulatory agency, and can it actually operate on a science basis in its efforts to live up to its own charter?
Sure. I want to open answer this question by saying I don't know that much about what happened with the EPA and coal. Although right. I can respond to all other elements of the question, but I'd be interested. Can you tell me a little bit more about what happened with the coal?
It was an issue where I believe states sued and said that they could regulate the smokestacks in their state, where the EPA was declaring the obvious that smoke from a coal-fired plant on the Ohio River, where I grew up in Cincinnati, clearly flows over the river into Kentucky, too. So it's truly an interstate issue. But my reading of it was that the court said that states can maintain jurisdiction, and they overruled the EPA.
Interesting. Well, yeah, so I'll kind of start with where the I'm not going to talk about that. I don't know the exact genesis of the jobs-killing rhetoric, although there's some good studies on that show that it was a well-hatched talking point that has been employed since about the 80s, since the Reagan era. And it really picked up its steam again after Obama became president. We've written about that on the Smog blog, and it's been well-tested by the likes of Frank Luntz and many other operatives. But so this whole thing with jobs killing and the what you said about renamed the EPA
Employment Prevention Agency.
Exactly. So that there's a sort of a related term that popped up through the American Legislative Exchange Council, calling the EPA the regulatory train wreck, sort of the institution that kills jobs. And so they passed this resolution in December of 2010 at their national meeting, and basically the resolution says that these states who are passing these resolutions are saying the EPA should for 24 months stop enforcing greenhouse gas emissions because they kill jobs. And although that's not true at all, there's been many studies that show that EPA regulations create jobs. That hasn't stopped the resolution from passing in 13 states and from being proposed in 34 states. I want to say one more thing. So the model bill was not only an ALEC model bill, but actually went to another organization, one of the groups that I call the other ALECs, the Council of State Governments. And it passed at their Southern Legislative Conference in July of 2011, a conference that was heavily attended by oil, gas, and nuclear industry lobbyists, and also heavily subsidized by them. One more thing. So we'll talk about that, but also want to talk about the fact that, you know, the EPA, although there's all this rhetoric about it being a jobs killing and it kind of puts the boot on the neck of industry. The truth is that the EPA is heavily, you know, there's a revolving door between the industry and the EPA, and there's been lots of news stories about that. And it's all you have to do is look at the biographies of many of the upper level personnel of the EPA to see that, you know, even if they were enforcing regulations, it would probably not be fully enforcing them, may not be enforcing them at all. But it's just, what's more important is the rhetoric and the propaganda, which many people end up believing in. That part of the equation is much more important. So even many of the propagandists probably don't even believe what they're saying because they know that the EPA is not a strict enforcement agency. But I don't think that's as important.
Well, and let me just clarify, at least from my point of view, the cycle of hypocrisy, that the Republicans who have created the economic crisis that has led to widespread unemployment use that unemployment as a wedge to unravel reasonable environmental regulation and protection and to allow industry to profit and pollute without any real consequences. Would you agree?
Yeah. And the most important part is the fact that regulations create jobs because if you actually have a heavily staffed regulatory agency, that would mean that there are many people on the ground doing well inspections around the country, looking at coal mines, just making sure that the law that's in place is being followed. What's happened is they've actually cut funding for all these agencies in many states. So you look at Pennsylvania and you look at one half of the wells are being inspected. You look at Pennsylvania and you look at Ohio, one tenth of the wells are being inspected. This was shown through research done by Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability. It's an NGO. So, it's all based on lies, but that means you have to dig deep to realize that they're lies. I think if the talking points do work when people are desperate for jobs and they don't see that where lots of jobs are coming into play, those are being cut so that industry can make a lot of money. And that's the key here, the key point not talked about at all.
Yeah. And in almost every case where Republicans trumpet job creation, the numbers are grossly inflated. And we saw that in any honest analysis of the Keystone XL pipeline. The claims of job creation are inflated by a factor of 6 to 10. And, they get away with it. The media, which has advertising sponsorship from the very companies that are promoting Keystone and other projects, turns a blind eye and turns into a stenographic service to report things without critical analysis or commentary. And Steve Horn, that's what you provide, and I really appreciate that. It's nice to talk with you again, and I want people to visit dsmogblog.com. How many other research fellows are there who are your colleagues?
I am the only one. There are a few regular contributors besides me, and then there's the executive director, Brendan DeMel. So it's basically five or six regular writers. I'm kind of his sidekick on a lot of projects, and that's kind of how it flows.
All right. Great to talk to you again, Steve. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, as always. Your comments are welcome. Send your email to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.